This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Until the May 2020 police killing of George Floyd and the mass uprising that it sparked, most non-Black Americans had never heard of Juneteenth. The name Juneteenth is short for June 19th, the day in 1865 when enslaved African Americans in Texas were finally informed of the Emancipation Proclamation that ensured their freedom, almost 2.5 years after it was signed by President Abraham Lincoln. In June 2021, President Joe Biden signed a proclamation declaring Juneteenth a federal holiday and calling it, quote, a day in which we remember the moral stain and terrible toll of slavery on our country, what I've long called America's original sin. This year, as Juneteenth falls on Father's Day, cities around the country are marking the day with festivals, block parties, concerts, and more. But as Biden said in his proclamation, slavery has left behind a, quote, long legacy of systemic racism, inequality, and inhumanity, which the federal holiday and yearly celebrations do little to address. To understand the history and significance of Juneteenth, and what it will take to move beyond symbolism, we turn today to Dr. Yohuru Williams. He is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of St. Thomas. He's the author of Black Politics, White Power, Civil Rights, Black Power, and Black Panthers in New Haven, and Teaching U.S. History Beyond the Textbook. I spoke with Dr. Williams for Yes Magazine, where I am the racial justice editor.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So let's first talk about just the basics around Juneteenth. This is an event, a yearly anniversary that not many Americans probably still know about, although last year President Biden signed a declaration making it a federal holiday. The year before that, we had President Donald Trump seeming to think that he had discovered it and brought it to the rest of America. But of course, African Americans have been celebrating Juneteenth for a very long time. How do you explain to someone who still may be unfamiliar what Juneteenth is?
Well, and you're right. It really came into national consciousness in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. Of course, George Floyd is murdered in May of 2020, and Juneteenth is typically celebrated on June 19th. So the murder of George Floyd and the racial unrest that happened in the country coming in such close proximity to Juneteenth, with so much emphasis at that time on longstanding issues with regard to police brutality and housing and the social determinants of health, put a renewed focus on Juneteenth as a holiday, as part of this kind of racial reckoning. And what ended up happening, at least in 2020, is it brought attention to a holiday which was very widely acknowledged and celebrated in the African-American community. And June 19th, or Juneteenth as it's called, is the day that slavery was officially abolished in Texas. It's a result of Gordon Granger's field order, which basically extended the Emancipation Proclamation to Texas. And the important thing to note about that is, often when people talk about emancipation, they talk about the end of the Civil War, they tend to think about Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation ending slavery. And Lincoln issues that in January of 1863. The reality is that the Union Army was the guarantor of the Emancipation Proclamation. And so if the Union Army, often what would happen is, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation was basically ignored unless the Union Army came in and actively took steps to ensure that the slaves who were living in that area were freed. That's certainly what happens with Texas. And so the reason it becomes kind of synonymous with Emancipation Day and Emancipation celebrations is Texas is the last holdout. It is in some sense seen as the kind of last bastion. And this is the last effort by the Union Army under Granger to free the slaves in that area. So it's really Emancipation Day in Texas, but it's been adopted by the African-American community as a whole to symbolize the meaning of freedom for all African Americans in that moment.
Do you think that it is a more appropriate day to celebrate American independence than July 4th?
I think there's room for both. I think it's interesting because for a lot of people on the 4th of July, they often read a document, a speech like Frederick Douglass's, What is the 4th of July to the Negro? in which Frederick Douglass, you know, ponders the meaning of the 4th of July and a celebration of freedom for people who are held in human bondage, you know, completely contrary to the values espoused by the founders in the Declaration of Independence and even in the preambles of the Constitution itself. So now if you celebrate both Juneteenth as Emancipation Day and then you celebrate the 4th of July, it's kind of completing this arc and telling the story about the paradox of American slavery and American freedom. A freedom that's built on human bondage, on the inequality that's imposed on, at the time of the Civil War, 4.5 million African slaves. And then this idea of, if not reconciliation, at least evolution, that what you have in 1865, by virtue not of the Civil War, but by virtue of the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, is a new birth of freedom. In fact, more appropriately, it's the 14th Amendment, which confers citizenship on the former freedmen, that becomes this kind of new baseline for freedom.
And then let's get into this disconnect between stated ideals and reality, which seems to be the constant tension in this country right from the start of its origin. Right from its origin, we have stated ideals that we as a nation have not lived up to. On racial justice, it seems as though especially that is true. When Biden signed the bill last year to make Juneteenth a federal holiday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said, we must continue to work to ensure equal justice. So they created this holiday, but didn't really give it any teeth beyond the fact that federal workers can take the day off. Why is that? And isn't that where the fight really is for racial justice?
Well, you know, it's appropriate in a sense that, like any other federal holiday, that is, you know, the way that, you know, it's dependent on whether it's adopted by employers and so on and so forth. And you've seen this kind of embrace of Juneteenth, particularly in the aftermath of George Floyd, that wasn't there before. The federal holiday status is important. There was some real concern in the African-American community. And the same thing happened a few years back when there was this fight for Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a holiday to commemorate the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, that if the holiday is simply about people taking the day off, it doesn't really commit anyone to active memory about why the holiday is significant. Unlike the 4th of July, where you're celebrating, in some sense, the United States winning its independence from Great Britain, what you're talking about is the aftermath of the imposition of chattel slavery in the United States and the continuing lingering harm and trauma that's been created by that. And so there are a lot who made the case that, no, we want the federal holiday. We appreciate that recognition of this as an emancipatory moment. At the same time, we would like for this holiday to pivot around some deeper commitment to racial justice and to dismantling systemic racism and systemic injustice in ways that are meaningful, that will put some real meaning behind the language and the aspirational language of the Declaration of Independence so that it really applies to American society and culture. And the only way that that'll be possible is if we're talking about real change in the African-American community in particular, around housing, education, access to places of public accommodation, dealing with issues associated with the social determinants of health. And for a lot of people right now, what's most visible, the challenges associated with police brutality and the treatment of Black and Brown people in public space.
And then we also have resurgent violent white supremacy, as the horrific massacre in Buffalo demonstrated, a white supremacist killer who clearly targeted elderly Black people.
Yeah, that's a huge, now this is the interesting thing about our contemporary moment, is if we think back to even going back to Mother Emanuel in South Carolina and playing that forward to Georgia and then playing that forward to Buffalo this year, violence has always been the response to agitation on the part of African Americans in particular for civil rights, for change. And so this is not, you know, this is something that we associate with moments like this in our history. In the aftermath of the Civil War, there was tremendous violence that took place in the South to try to deny African-Americans the opportunity to enjoy the full fruits of their freedom. Certainly during the Civil Rights Movement, tremendous violence accompanied the push for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. In fact, we associate with the passage of those two major pieces of legislation, infamous murders, which really spurred the government to action in those moments, including the killing of Jimmie Lee Jackson in 1965 and the beating of John Lewis and others on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, that will become the impetus for Johnson signing the Voting Rights Act of 1965 into law. In our contemporary moment, as we have so much legislation that still needs to be passed, so much conversation about the George Floyd Policing Act and dealing with that issue, this feels a lot like that backlash that we tend to associate with periods like this in our history, where there seems to be tremendous gain, but then there is, as Nina Simone famously put in a song, a backlash blues that results in this kind of rising tide of resentment and anger, which often results in violence.
Understanding what Juneteenth is requires history and the study of history. Your field, which is of course tremendously under attack by the right as part of their ongoing culture wars for at least the past 2 years, how have these attacks on critical race theory and on history in general, a true history of America when it comes to race, how have those made it harder for historians like yourself to explore what things like Juneteenth mean?
Well, it's made it really difficult, and it's definitely part of the backlash. So if we go back to 2017, for example, the big conversation nationally was around Confederate monuments. And that at its core is a question of history, contested history. This idea that, you know, the Confederate flag flying above state houses in the South is a symbol of Southern heritage rather than a symbol of white terror. And I think that the January 6th insurrection made clear, when those rioters came to the Capitol bearing symbols of white supremacy, the noose and the Confederate flag, what that heritage and what that history is. At the same time, there's been this assault on the teaching of African-American history packaged under the propaganda of critical race theory, which has nothing to do with what's taught in K-12 education. Critical race theory is a lens adopted by legal scholars that put race at the center as a method of analysis for fundamentally asking the question that why, in spite of so much legislation in the 1960s, had there been no real substantive gains in conquering racial inequality in America? That's not what's taught in K-12 education. For myself, recently I had an opportunity to go down to Florida after they canceled a professional development with a college professor there and a teacher that was supposed to be on the teaching of the civil rights movement. And what the district officials found objectionable in the materials that had been put together for that professional development was the teacher who had included an image of Colin Kaepernick taking the knee alongside images of peaceful protesters from the civil rights movement. And I found that interesting because how are you supposed to teach the civil rights movement without talking about the strategies and tactics adopted by activists in that moment to raise consciousness about what was happening to African Americans in the United States at that time? I ended up, when I went down, talking about another moment in our history, and that was 1986, the Challenger. And the reason that I mentioned and thought it would be appropriate to talk about that with those teachers is it's something that happened in Florida, but it's an interesting moment. If you were to look at the crew of the Challenger spacecraft that was supposed to go up in 1986 that unfortunately exploded shortly after takeoff, it's a portrait of America that really represents the America that I'd like to live in. We often think about that moment because of Krista McAuliffe, the teacher in space, but Ellison Onizuka, Japanese-American crew member, was part of that trip. We had two women, Krista McAuliffe, who was there, and Judith Resnick, who was Jewish, of Jewish ancestry. You've got Ronald McNair, African-American, man of color, descendant of sharecroppers and slaves. That's a portrait of America that we aspire to, but the only way that we can tell that story as a story of triumph is if we honestly tell the story each of the individuals who was there that day. The repression that African Americans faced in American history, the repression that Asian Americans, particularly Japanese and Chinese Americans on the West Coast faced, from the Japanese internment to a denial of the ability to own homes, and residential segregation, to the challenges that Jewish people of Jewish ancestry have faced. So when we teach our history honestly, that's when we're in the best position to really evolve our democracy and Republican form of government. We can't do that by hiding our history. In fact, one of the interesting things that I told those Florida educators is, if they don't believe me, they can quote the patron saint of conservatism, Ronald Reagan. After the Challenger went down, he had the unenviable task of addressing the American people that evening about what they saw. And in this very powerful speech that's crafted for him by Peggy Noonan, the president says, and he's trying to make this contrast between the U.S. and the Soviet Union at that time, we don't hide things. We don't run from our mistakes. We do it the way democracy should do it, up front and in public. That's the way democracy is, he says, and I quote, and I wouldn't change it for a thing. To those who try to argue that we shouldn't be teaching difficult aspects of our history, talking about African-American history, and want to decry that as critical race theory, allow me to quote Ronald Reagan. We don't hide from our history. We have to face it and take it on. That's how democracy grows. We wouldn't have it any other way.
Yehuru, what do you think that we need to be thinking about as a country when we celebrate Juneteenth this year? It's been 2 years since George Floyd's killing. The racial justice uprisings seemed to be a pivotal moment in the United States with unprecedented numbers, millions of Americans marching all over the country. Police brutality seemed to be laid bare as, you know, police seemed unencumbered in their brutality, unleashed it quite indiscriminately on journalists and even white protesters. And then it sort of slipped away. This call to defund the police got ridiculed. And now we're seeing liberals and Democrats worried about supposedly rising crime rates, say that, no, we must continue to invest in police. It seems as though we had this moment 2 years ago, but it's slipping away.
Well, and this is the difficult challenge ahead of us, is the problem with Americans, and I quote William Dean Howell's famous advice to Edith Wharton, as she was beginning her writing career. He said to her, you know, recognize that the American public always wants a tragedy with a happy ending. Our narrative is always, we were in this place and then some piece of legislation or some charismatic leader came along and we changed for the better, and we don't revisit the ugliness that proves that these are a lot of unfinished revolutions that we're still dealing with in terms of our history and culture. Certainly that's the case with Reconstruction, it's unfinished business. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments are insufficient to ensure absolute equality before the law for African Americans. And that's why we find ourselves in the conundrum we find ourselves in today. One could make the argument the same thing for the women's rights movement. The 19th Amendment, if it had been so effective, we wouldn't still be talking about ERA and the challenges to gender equality today. So our desire for a tragedy with a happy ending, our desire to say, you know, George Floyd was murdered, but look at all the change that's happened since then, undermines our ability to do the deeper substantive work necessary to make real change. I'll give you a very good example of that with regard to what happened 2 years ago. In the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd in June of 2020, Al Sharpton came to Minneapolis and delivered a memorial service for George Floyd, in which he said, that's about a different time and a different season, he said. And when I looked out and I saw in some cases young whites outnumbering the blacks marching, it was a different time and a different season. That's a great narrative, and it certainly was true at that moment. But if it's not sustainable, then the reality is what it is a moment and not a movement. And what we need in our country right now is a movement for social justice that's sustainable and longitudinal. It can't be about grand gestures like acknowledging Juneteenth as a holiday. It can't be about statements that businesses and corporations put out affirming their commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. It can't simply be about Facebook posts and social media activism. It really has to be about taking on the deeper structural challenges that continue to create inequality and promote inequality in our society as a whole. And that's not going to be a tragedy with a happy ending. That's going to be a lot of hard work.
That's a perfect note to end on. Yehuru Williams, thank you so much for all you do and for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
My guest is Dr. Yohuru Williams, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of St. Thomas, author of Black Politics, White Power, and Teaching U.S. History Beyond the Textbook. I spoke with Dr. Williams for Yes Magazine, where I'm the racial justice editor. You can read the transcript of my interview at yesmagazine.org later this week. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website at risingupwithsonali.com by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.